welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 23. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at a couple of really cool films. The first one of which is 1957's The 27th Day, starring Gene Barry. And the other one is a classic of Roger Corman's 1970s output, the Paul Bartel-directed Death Race 2000, starring David Carradine, Sylvester Stallone, and Simone Griffith. So sit back, grab some junk food, and we'll get on with taking a look at how the 1970s saw the future and the 1950s saw the Cold War. The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a fortnightly podcast looking at science fiction, fantasy, and horror movies. They can be old or new, good or bad, English language or not. All they have to be is interesting. Feedback is our Soylent Green here, so you can email, text, or record voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U. Or go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. Or the preferred option, you can call our new voicemail number 206-33-77721. Now, it's all about the love of fantastic cinema, and it's all about cancelling the apocalypse. How is everybody? It's a lovely day here. It's about 30 degrees centigrade, and if you're a part of the world that uses Fahrenheit, more's the pity. So things are going okay. We're heading into the Newton Mass season. As long-time listeners will know, I don't celebrate Christmas because I'm not a Christian, but I do celebrate Newton Mass, which celebrates the birth of Isaac Newton on the 25th of December, and people who celebrate Newton Mass give gifts of information, so movies, music, books, cool things like that. No socks, no jocks, no aftershave. It's all about the information. So that's what we're doing this year. And for that matter, pretty much every year. So, yep, looking at a couple of movies, one of which I saw originally at the cinema. The other one I saw on a late night TV viewing, probably in the late 1960s. So, you know it's got to be good. The first one is, of course, Death Race 2000, not the stupid remake with Jason Statham, but the original directed by Paul Bartel. And the second one is The 27th Day, a little Cold War science fiction effort from Columbia Pictures from 1957, starring Gene Barry, who I have a lot of time for. I always liked Gene Barry as an actor because I used to watch him when I was a very small child in TV series like Bat Masterson, Burke's Law, Amos Burke's Secret Agent, Name of the Game, The Adventurer, and all the other things that he did in the way back days before most of the people listening to this were born. But on other things, what have I been watching? Been watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which I think really does need to pick up its game a little bit in order to maintain a decent batting average and to be worth keeping on. Person of Interest is very interesting. It's the stealthiest science fiction TV series in the history of TV, in a sense. It looks like it's a cop vigilante type show, but in essence what it is the birth of a benign AI, a singularity. Which is not going to mean a lot to people who don't know what a benign AI is or a singularity, but that's what it is essentially. And that makes it kind of interesting from a speculative fiction viewpoint. And a lot of science fiction fans just don't know about it or don't really realize that it's deeply science fictional, even though the day-to-day stuff tends to be very much vigilante action stuff against Russian mafia, corrupt police, and some old-school mafiosi. However, underlying that, there's that speculation about artificial intelligence and what would actually happen in the real world were one to manifest. So that keeps me going and is kind of cool. I'm watching Arrow, the TV series based on the Green Arrow comics, which is kind of finding its ground in the second series and is worth checking out a bit. And apart from that, just the usual Australian political shows, which unfortunately are going into a Christmas hiatus at the moment. So my Monday night tweeting at Q&A in the hope of getting my tweets on the TV won't be happening until next year. And my Sunday morning dose of political stuff with Barry Cassidy on Insiders isn't going to happen. So I'm kind of lost 2 days a week now over the end of year break. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do with that time, except maybe get ready for podcasting in a little more timely fashion than I've done in the past. On the cinema front, I have seen a couple of things that I'd recommend. The first one is Riddick, the third Vin Diesel Riddick movie. The second one went off track with all that stuff about Judi Dench being a fairy or something. But the third one gets back on track and keeps it dead simple. Riddick's dumped on a desert planet with lots of mean monsters and has to get off. Bottom line, dead simple stuff. Done really well. He gets an alien dog as a pet. There are some incredibly nasty beasties on the planet, and a whole bunch of bounty hunters land after he sets off an emergency beacon to bring his head back to civilization. Not the whole of him, just his head, because the bounty is more if he's dead. So that I would recommend, because it's pared back science fiction. It's a little like the Harry Harrison Death World things. It's very knowing. David Toohey is a very fine director. I've talked about one of his movies in Martian Drive-In before, being Timescape. Yep. And I really recommend it. It's not going to be intellectually riveting, but it's a good, honest action flick, and I kind of like it for that reason. I like the fact that it doesn't try to be everything to everybody, and goes dead for the thing that made Pitch Black work, which is one tough-ass motherfucker against monsters on an alien planet. That's it. That's all it needs to be. So I'll definitely be picking that one up on Blu-ray in a few weeks when it comes out. The other thing I've seen, which is quite funny, if you know the actors, is This Is the End. It stars Seth Rogen, Jay Baruchel, James Franco, Danny McBride, Craig Robinson, and all sorts of other people in it. Basically a bunch of Hollywood actors with too much privilege and too much money face the apocalypse. So they're playing versions of themselves in this one. And if you like the actors, or even if you don't like some of them, this one's quite funny. Things go to shit very fast. The demons start taking over people. People are caught up by the rapture. And Danny McBride has a really nice end bit where he kind of embraces the apocalypse. So it's quite fun. Both Sal and I enjoyed it. It's transgressive. And even though Seth Rogen's idea of heaven isn't my idea of heaven, it's still a cool film to enjoy. And it's a little bit of some Hollywood actors piss-taking themselves. So that one, if you're into that kind of mood and into that kind of movie, definitely go with it. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to do the 27th day, followed quickly, of course, by Death Race 2000.
Sleepy and yawning, still the taste of wine. Then I remember you're mine, and I've got a world that's fine. What's before me? Routines that bore me. Punch the clock at 8. But what a lucky guy I am, I've got a world that's great. Atom bombs, Cape Canaveral and false alarms, half the universe is up in arms. So I flip a little too until I'm holding you. Watch the hassle, I'll buy the castle, we can live like kings. If we're together forever, I've got a world that you've got, a world that we've got, a world that swings. I'd like to take you through this wild, wonderful venture. Fly like a kite through space, no strings. I don't want to lose that bell that rings. I've got a world that you've got, a world that we've got, a world that swings. World that swings.
That, of course, was Jerry Lewis from the good version of The Nutty Professor, which, in a sense, is kind of a remake of a slightly earlier Hammer film, which Hammer haven't yet released. It's a movie starring Bernard Breslau called The Ugly Duckling. And it's basically Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde done in a modern time. And I saw it years and years ago, but I haven't been able to find a copy of it since then. If anybody can hook me up with a copy, even a bad one, of The Ugly Duckling, I would appreciate it. Having said that, it's time to move on to the 27th day.
In just a few moments, these five: American newspaper man, English bathing beauty, German scientist, Russian soldier, Chinese peasant girl, will be given the power to destroy every human being on Earth. What will they do? What will their governments force them to do? What would you do?
Each of the capsules has a diameter of lethal radiation, which is exactly 3,000 miles. There is then, in the combined capsules, more than enough power to wipe out all human life on your planet. People of Earth, I am an alien from outer space.
Police looking for Jonathan Parker.
Don't say anything. I thought you'd never make it.
How long are we going to stay here, just hiding like hunted animals?
You don't think I like hiding, do you?
We've been here 10 days. We've managed to disagree on every one of them.
Actually, we've had all the disadvantages of marriage without any of the advantages.
Jonathan?
But it's true.
It's time I went to bed.
Demand is hereby made for the immediate withdrawal of all American forces and civilians on land, sea, and air
to within the limits of continental United States on pain of total war.
Every human being alive will die unless science solves the riddle of the destruction capsules from outer space before the 27th day.
Answer me, Klaus. Where are they?
I've launched them.
Soon the world will be ours.
There you go, the usual 1950s bombastic Columbia Pictures trailer for the movie. In spite of that, it is quite interesting. It was directed by William Asher, who directed one of my favourite early 1960s forgotten crime movies, being Johnny Cool with Henry Silver, whose name has been given to Silver and Gold podcast. Really good stuff. He then went on to not only marry Elizabeth Montgomery, but he was the driving force behind Bewitched, the TV series, and made his fortune doing that. Though he did start out doing TV series before 27th Day. He directed a lot of I Love Lucy's and Make Room for Daddy and all sorts of sitcom-y kind of two-camera set-up 1950s sitcoms. But in this one, he kind of went in a different direction. The movie stars, and it has quite a good cast, Gene Barry, Valerie French, who was once Doctor Who's sister-in-law, and I'll explain that later, George Vosovic, Arnold Moss, and a really interesting character actor called Stefan Schnabel, who was part of the Mercury Theatre back in the 1930s, working with Orson Welles on a lot of projects. He was actually born in Germany, and in the very early 1930s, 1933, his family fled to America. And during World War II, Stefan Schnabel, he plays the Russian general who's trying to destroy the world, basically. I'll explain that in a moment. But Stefan Schnabel was really interesting. During World War II, he worked for the OSS, so he was a secret agent in a sense, and did literally thousands of radio plays through the 1930s and 1940s. And in this one, he does play a pretty good villain as well. For those who didn't get it from the trailer, the setup is this: five people from around the world, none of whom happens to be African, are captured by an alien played by Arnold Moss, who has very regal bearing and a very great voice. Who tells them that he's going to give them little capsule, three little capsules in a little box. And any one of those capsules, if they open it, the box with their minds, pull a little pin out of one of the capsules, and then recite the latitude and longitude of any given destination, will destroy all human life within a 3,000-mile radius of that point. He then gives all five of them one of those and sends them back with the hope that they will fuck up and destroy the world, and then his people can take over the world and get the planet for themselves without losing a lot of the infrastructure. So basically, it's an analogy for the Cold War and the mutually assured destruction philosophy that was behind a lot of that. So there are five people in who have this terror weapon, in a sense. There's Jonathan Clark, played by Jean Barry, who's a newspaper reporter from California. Valerie French plays Eve Wingate, an English woman who doesn't seem to have any occupation. George Vosovic plays Professor Klaus Bechner, who is a German nuclear physicist, in a sense. And there are two other people, a Russian soldier and a Chinese peasant woman, who don't do very well at all in this movie. Su Tan, the Chinese woman, played by an actress called Marie Sien, doesn't get any dialogue and pretty much commits suicide right after she gets back to Earth after the aliens take them up the spaceship, explain that they can blow up the world with these little pills, and then sends them back again. The Russian soldier, Ivan Godovsky, played by Azamat Janti, who has five or six things in his IMDb, one of which is an episode of Sugarfoot, the TV series starring Will Hutchins in 1959, something called The Beast of Budapest, a TV series called Telephone Time, a TV series called The Millionaire, and Family Theatre. So he didn't have a long career as an actor. And if you see the movie, you can kind of suspect why. Not that good, but then he doesn't have much to work with. All he has to do is say yes sir a lot, get tortured, and then jump out of a window. So the non-intellectual, non-English speaking people don't do well in this film. And by the way, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen it, see it, then listen to the podcast. Anyway, Jonathan goes back to California and kind of hides out. Eve, having spotted him on the spaceship and they exchanged a few words, decides to fly to California from England. And he finds her at the airport because he's been waiting for her after he gets a phone call from her saying she's coming over. They hide out in some accommodation in an off-season racetrack. Now, I spent some time in the 1960s when I was a child hanging around racetracks and stables and things like that. And to be honest with you, it wouldn't have been the nicest accommodation around. But they kind of do that meet cute, and then they get together and they find out that they're in love. Stock standard stuff for 1950s science fiction, or any other kind of movie for that matter, with the possible exception of Audie Murphy war films. And the alien doesn't play fair with them either. He takes over all of the television and radio broadcasts in the world and basically outs these five people in order to make sure that the authorities know they're there and they can't just hide, and they have to respond to the threat and the temptation of these tiny little weapons that can destroy a continent. Eve does the smartest thing of all of the people. If everybody, all five of them, had done this at the start of the film, there wouldn't be anything to discuss. She goes to the beach of Cornwall, throws her one in the ocean. End of problem. She's made an instant moral decision and just done it. Now, the other people, and also if you die, if you're one of these five people and you die, the little compact thing with the capsules in it becomes inert and useless. When the Chinese woman dies, this being an American film from 1957, you've got a Cold War aspect. A Russian general, who is never named, played by Stefan Schnabel, decides that he wants to get the weapon and threaten America with it, threaten them all to withdraw to the borders of the US, and then at a time just before the 27-day deadline is over and the whole thing becomes moot, launch the little capsules at America, thereby destroying it, thereby conquering the world, thereby having a lot of medals on his chest. Which is really kind of odd, because from what we know of the military and political structure of the Soviet Union at the time, nobody makes an arbitrary decision like that. It goes through committees and discussions. It goes right up to the premier. It's kind of unrealistic that this happens, but it's done for the sake of the drama of it. And to demonise, of course, communism and the evils of communism in the form of a German guy who fled the Nazis. Now, having said all that, it's a very competent little thriller. It sets up the premise really neatly at the start of the film and plays it through with some interesting twists that I'll have a word about in just a moment. But it does, basically it is saying there's an immense power in the world, the nuclear weapon, and it's in the hands of a few people. But what if there was something even more powerful that's in the hands of ordinary people? And then, you know, what would happen based on that? And it follows through that premise pretty well. It's a good speculation about things. There's a lot of talk about nuclear weapons. There's a lot of talk about the Cold War. And then they kind of spoil it at the end, but I can't blame them because there's a couple of things you need to remember about a movie made in 1957 as a kind of B picture. First off, they didn't know they were going to have 60 years later, a whole, well, 50 odd years later, a whole bunch of people around the world sitting in front of a little screen speculating about their film. They thought people would go and see it at a drive-in or at a hard-top cinema, enjoy it, pay their money, and go home. They didn't think it would have such a long tail. Also, the other side of it is, even if people did speculate about the film, they didn't have a medium for doing so to a large audience. At most, they'd be talking to the other people in the car at the drive-in about this bit didn't make sense or this bit did make sense. If they're a newspaper critic, maybe they'd have a little more to say about it, but there tended to be very limited word count in those columns, particularly about a science fiction film at the time. Therefore, the whole wonderful and complex apparatus we know as being a movie buff in the 21st century, nobody could even speculate that that existed. So the twists and turns they threw into the movie, from their point of view, would have had minimum impact and would have been cheered by their proposed audience of 1950s, not-so-left-wing people with crew cuts and ties and short-sleeved button-down shirts, and women in frocks with white gloves and hats. And here comes the spoilers. Just as the American military is withdrawing into the continental United States as demanded by the Russians who have their finger on the little capsule button, the professor starts speculating about little etchings on the side of the capsules, and he translates them and finds out that they're not quite what they seem to be. Even though they've tested one of them and destroyed a friendly scientist who decided that he was going to force their hand and use him as a guinea pig by dosing himself up with gamma rays in a very non-Bruce Banner kind of way, giving himself a fatal radiation overdose so they'd have to test the capsule on him in the open ocean east of South America, Professor Beckner launches the capsules all around the world. He uses his own capsules, he uses Jonathan's capsules. And what the capsules do is this, and this is the bit that I have a problem with. They destroy all enemies of freedom in the world with a high-pitched sound that basically pierces their skull and kills them. Now, the concept of enemies of freedom is a very odd one to use. Not odd in the sense of the times it was made in, because it would have meant evil communist bastards to the people who saw the film in 1957. But it does leave the speculation that if all enemies of freedom were destroyed by this, did it kill J. Edgar Hoover? Did it kill all the CIA people who were doing the MK Ultra program? Did it kill all of the doctors who were dosing up black people in Tuskegee with syphilis? Did it kill all the white segregationists in the South? Did it kill wife beaters and child raping priests and all those other people around the place as well? It's an interesting thing that if that were to happen as a kind of reverse rapture in a sense, who would it kill? It makes it a very 1950s film, and unfortunately dates it a little bit and makes it a little bit hinky from our point of view. So the UN has a great big kumbaya moment and sends out a radio signal to the aliens saying, please come and share our planet. We don't want, you know, we didn't die, but we don't mind you sharing our planet. We've got tons of deserts and other wilderness areas you can destroy with your civilization if you want to, so please come and join us. They didn't get a signal back saying, welcome to the Galactic Federation, people of Earth. Everything's going to be wonderful and you're going to have technological miracles and travel to the stars. Da, 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 the end. Now, I saw this film originally, as I said, as a kid in the 1960s. And I liked it at the time. Having had a somewhat fraught childhood, it occurred to me that one of the enemies of freedom who would have been destroyed was my own father. But that's a very personal matter and another thing. But I liked the speculation of it. I liked the fact that the movie played with ideas in an adventure format. And I liked the fact that he was a good, honest 1950s programmer in the science fiction genre, which ended up, and it had somebody I liked in it too. I was very fond of Jean Barry as an actor, I still am. So the movie was a lot better than some of the other things I saw at the time, like Red Planet Mars, where Peter Graves and the actress playing his wife get signals from God, who's living on Mars for some reason. And there's all sorts of really icky religious stuff in that film, which pissed me off to the point where I've never watched it since then. I was an atheist from a fairly early age. But then I was thinking about it when I watched it this time, and I watched it a couple of hours ago, that what the aliens are doing is kind of a really silly test, in a sense. Yeah, they want to see which civilizations are suitable to hang out in the galactic clubhouse and be a part of a much greater civilization. Yeah, that's fair enough in that. But what they're doing to test civilizations for that particular honor is the equivalent of putting a baby in a bank vault with a loaded pistol. They're chucking in a weapon to beings that may or may not be ready for it and just leaving them to see whether they kill themselves or not. There's a very dark and not too nice morality about what those guys are doing. It's, yeah, there's nothing they couldn't have found out just by listening to radio broadcasts or sending down their patrician-looking alien representatives to hang out on Earth for a while and just see what we're really like. Instead, they decide they got all these capsules lying around. They've all got a 3,000-kilometer death radius. How about we just chuck a bunch of them at these inferior beings and see whether they come up to scratch? Really a morally ambiguous one, and I think that whether a grown-up in this film, in the sense that we now know grown-ups to be, when they get to the Galactic Federation, they punch out the first alien they saw and go, you pricks, you nearly killed us. Yeah, it's something to think about. But I suppose you've got to consider they come from a culture where that kind of gumbo diplomacy was not entirely unknown. So it wasn't particularly seen as at all morally ambiguous at the time. I suppose it'd be really nice to do a coda to the end of that. So you've got these 1950s countries around the world who agree to become part of the galactic civilization. And they fly up to the spaceship and the Galactic Federation says to them, okay, yep, everything Galactic Federation, only you've got to let women have birth control, you've got to let all races be equal, you've got to let gays and lesbians marry and not persecute them. Oh, and also you've got to be really fair to women for a change. Equal pay, equal rights, rape in marriage will henceforth be considered a crime. No smoking because that shit kills you. And then the people from Earth just kind of look at each other and go back in the spaceship and go back again. I would pay cash money to see that part. But having taken the piss out of it, I do like the movie. If you look at it as an artifact of its time and realise that the people in it were a part of a culture that was under somebody else's bomb sites, while indeed they were putting other people under their bomb sites, you can kind of wear it like that. Oh, by the other way, the other thing too is, one of the radio announcers in the movie is Paul Frees, who people might know from a lot of the Disney work he did. Paul Frees was also an FBI informant who dobbed in a lot of actors and other people in the industry to the FBI for anti-American activities. So every time I see Paul Frees in a movie, I just look at him and go, you prick. Anyway, I'm going to take another break now, and when I get back, we're going to a slightly more civilized time, 1975, for the Roger Corman-produced, Paul Bartel-directed bit of fun called Death Race 2000.
The year 2000. America is a vast speedway. People line the streets to witness the greatest drivers on Earth in a race from sea to shining sea.
This is a death race.
You finish first, or not at all. Death Race 2000. Every car a deadly weapon. Every spectator a potential point.
stolen. It's a cross-country road wreck, and the traffic is murder.
Who are you anyway?
Frankenstein. National hero. Best driver on earth.
I don't want you to die.
He was built by the world's finest surgeons to drive the fastest car ever designed, and nothing can stop him now. Death Race 2000, rated R.
Okay, so Death Race 2000, a Roger Corman joint directed by Paul Bartel, who you might remember from a couple of other films that I really like, at least. The first one of which being Eating Raoul, which he did with one of his co-star, one of the people who was in this movie, Mary Warrenoff and Robert Beltran. And the other movie I like of his is Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, which has Ed Begley Jr., Jacqueline Bisset, and Mary Warrenoff in it. So, anyway, Death Race 2000, we pretty much all know what it's about. I'll get you the IMDb blurb. In a dystopian future, a cross-country automobile race requires contestants to run down innocent pedestrians to gain points that are tallied based on each kill's brutality. And so they are. Now, this is an incredibly influential movie, not on cinema, but on computer games. Back about 15 years ago, there was a computer game called Carmageddon came out, which owed a hell of a lot to Death Race 2000. And then, of course, Grand Theft Auto came along, and that probably had a bit of a reliance on the ideas that came from Death Race 2000 as well. So without Death Race 2000, you wouldn't have had Grand Theft Auto, which is a billion-dollar business these days. So we can't really dismiss it as just a piece of fluff from the 1970s. Now, I saw this movie. I can't exactly recall which one of the two cinemas it was. But as I've said before in podcasts, back in the 1970s in Sydney, where I grew up, the really large, lavish cinemas, and they are and were indeed lavish, like the Capitol and the State Theatre, didn't have any great big blockbuster films to hang their hats on. So in order to keep going, they showed B-movies, blaxploitation films, titty films, the Cherry Cafaro Ginger Trilogy, anything they could get that would get some bums on the seats. They did. So it was either in the State or in the Capitol in Sydney that I saw Death Race 2000. Now, just imagine seeing a Roger Corman film in a theatre that's so grandiose you could redo the dueling scene from Scaramouche in it. It's that spectacular. They were marvellous 1930s flea pits and are now heritage listed and still going as live theatres. A lot of award shows, for instance, are at the State Theatre. And I kind of love the fact that those two in particular were preserved. There were other ones that I would have loved to have been preserved, like the Plaza or the Regent and George Street, but those two are the ones that really were iconic of their type. So I saw Death Race 2000 and I loved it because I was a teenage boy, and who the hell wouldn't love seeing a cross-country car race where you score points for hitting people? I was never much of a rev head myself. I only really got my driver's license in my 40s. But I can appreciate the aesthetic of it. Now, I'll give you a little bit of an audio grab from the movie of the scoring system for Death Race 2000.
It seems apparent that our citizens are staying off the streets, which may make scoring particularly difficult, even with this year's rule changes. To recap those revisions, women are still worth 10 points more than men in all age brackets, but teenagers now rack up 40 points, and toddlers under 12 now rate a big 70 points. The big score, anyone, any sex, over 75 years old, has been upped to 100 points. As always, how fast you move determines how long you live.
Okay, so that's it. America's bankrupt. The president lives overseas for some reason and is a mysterious character. And the death race has been going on for 20 years, which if you want to count back, would have been back to 1980 for some reason. With death, carnage, all sorts of stuff, and a whole cult has grown up around it. Now, originally, the original story that this was based on was pretty dark and grim, but Roger Corman, having his really fine sense of what is going to sell and what's not going to sell, took the original Ib Melchior story and gave it to Robert Tom and Charles Griffith to tart it up and to make it funny. He didn't want to have a grim and nasty, hard movie. He wanted something satirical and a bit lighter. The budget for it was around $300,000, and the cast needed to be made cheaply. So Roger Corman got a whole bunch of old Volkswagens, because they were rear-wheel drive and cheap, and gave them to somebody who did body work for cars, gave him an idea on what was required, and then let them go with it. And I think the cars do look good. They're quite fun, and they're quite iconic-looking vehicles, even though they're all more or less the same underneath the bodywork. In real life, the cars also went very fast, so they had to do a little bit of overcranking on the cameras to make them look faster. And indeed, some of them had to be pushed down hills to get them started. They were that kind of dodgy at best. Now, the cast of the film is quite cool. You've got, he said, looking it up, David Carradine straight off doing Kung Fu as Frankenstein, the most iconic of the races. You've got a very young and very early in his career, Sylvester Stallone as Machine Gun Joe Viterbo, who's a kind of mafiosi type in 1930s mafiosi kind of thing. This is one of his very early films. The only things he did before this were he played Frank Nitti and Capone in 75, but he had a bit part in Prisoner of Second Avenue, Lords of Flatbush, of course. He was in Clute as a discotheque patron. Bananas, Woody Allen film, was his third movie. No Place to Hide. Lovers and Other Strangers, another uncredited one. And his first film in 1970, of course, was the porn film The Party at Kitty and Studs, in case you didn't know. But this was his first, more or less, up there starring role, apart from Lords of Flatbush. You got Mary Warrenoff, who started out as part of the factory, Andy Warhol's movie making and artistic franchise in New York. She's quite good in this. I always liked Mary Warrenoff. I think she's a lot of fun. She plays Calamity Jane, who's in a bull modeled car, in a sense. Roberta Collins, who starred in a couple of other Roger Corman films, the women in prison kind of things, women in cages, and let's see what else she was in. She's in like two of them, Women in Cages and The Big Dollhouse. So she was in those two Filipino filmed Roger Corman action flicks. You got Martin Cove, who's been a heavy in action films ever since then, playing Nero the Hero, Roman kind of slightly gay car driver who doesn't last all that long. And you've got the co-driver, Simone Griffith, as Annie, who's Frankenstein's co-driver. You've got Larissa Maritza's Myra, who's Machine Gun Joe's offsider. And then you've got all of the people who are doing the coverage for Death Race 2000 for the media. You've got Joyce Jamison playing Grace Pander, who's one of those smarmy announcers, Don Steele as Junior Bruce, and Carl Benson as Harold, the guy who does the Howard Cosell imitations. I mean, this film has, it's very broad stuff. It's really, really broad comedy and broad satire. It's the bread and circuses kind of thing, where the public's kept happy with gory spectacle. It's political suppression. There's an anti-government group led by a woman called Thomasina Paine, who's supposed to be descended from Thomas Paine. But very much the political satire is secondary to the fact that lots of people get smashed by cars. And there are lots of gore effects in the movie which are hilariously cartoonish, and I don't think anybody could take them at all seriously. They're really Herschel Gordon Lewis level splatter, and only momentary splatter at that. So I don't think anybody's going to get really grossed out by it.
runs an engine like that, it's got to be the roughest, tough guy of them all, Machine Gun Joe Viterbo. Here he comes, Machine Gun Joe, loved by thousands, hated by millions. Only living previous winner except for Frankenstein, highest lifetime score after Frankenstein, and he's certainly getting the welcome he deserves. Joe doesn't look too happy, but you just can't keep those Frankenstein fans down.
Lousy sons of bitches.
Frankenstein!
Give it to them, Joe!
More Frankenstein!
And you can guess that that sound effect has followed Sylvester Stallone through much of his subsequent career. Never a very nuanced actor, and at the moment he's kind of an advertisement for plastic surgery and the misuse of human growth hormone. He doesn't look good for his age. I mean, yes, he's physically maybe fit as a Mallee Bull, but not a good look. He's looking like basically an erect cock that's been put through a car crusher. Not a good look at all. In The Expendables, I keep expecting him to burst a blood vessel and leak out like something out of Scanners. But having said that, even though he does play somebody who's supposed to be made out of spare parts, David Carradine's quite personable as Frankenstein. He's kind of cool and just plays a little Steve McQueen in places and ends up being much more likable character than you think at first. And Simone Griffith is very lovely as Annie, his navigator. Of course, being a 1970s Roger Corman film, there is gratuitous nudity in it for both sexes, though apparently Sylvester Stallone had an unusual reticence about having a bare bum while he was on the massage table, so they compromised and put a towel over his ass. Which is odd given the fact that everything was showing in Party at Kitty and Studs only 5 years earlier. But back to Carradine, he actually worked a couple more times for Roger Corman's New World Pictures. He did Cannonball a couple of years after Death Race 2000, which is about a cross-country race in modern times rather than in the future. And then he went on to do a futuristic kind of motorcycle-y weirdo thing called Death Sport in 1978 with the late Claudia Jennings and Richard Lynch, which in itself is a little bit interesting and does have a couple of weird influences from Star Wars, which just come out at the time, so it can be forgiven for being shit. But yeah, Carradine, of course, most known now, unfortunately, for the fact that he kind of died under unusual circumstances in 2009 after making Kill Bill and Kill Bill 2 and a couple of other lesser works. He died of autoerotic strangulation in Bangkok in Thailand, which is not something you can say about many people, I suppose. But, you know, he wasn't hurting anybody except himself, so I don't think there's too much you can criticize the guy for there. Yeah, he was kinky, but he wasn't hurting anyone. Now, as science fiction, the film isn't particularly good. The speculation is really ropey. The map painting at the start of the film, where in the big speedway where the race starts, is very, very naff. But I kind of like it. It's got an energy to it. And the car scenes, even though they are undercranked, sorry. I keep getting over and undercranked mix up. I do apologize. Undercranked is a lot of fun. And again, it's that kind of movie that influenced Death Proof, for instance. It's got that same kind of camera angles with the lowdown on the bumper of the car. And pretty much the same locations as well, even though it's supposed to have taken place all over America. All of it was filmed in Southern California, some of it in the San Fernando Valley, and a few other places, just to vary things up a little bit. But, yeah, it's a good, honest 1970s action film, in a sense. And, of course, there was the remake. There's been a couple of remakes, in fact. The first one with Jason Statham, which was so bad it's not worth talking more about. Unfortunate, but what can you do? And come to think of it, Death Race 2000 was pretty big in Australia. Played a lot of drive-ins. It played all over the place as well. And went into the kind of suburban cinemas months after its first release. And got a bit of box office there. So you could have... It's not too big a stretch to say that this one may well have influenced Mad Max as well. It's got that kind of, you know, rev-head future that George Miller was looking for when he did the first Mad Max movie, for instance. Even though, as they say on Key and Peele, Mad Max did star racist-ass Millie Gibson's. It's, you know, it's, these are iconic films of a certain type. And in that, we've got to kind of give them a little bit of kudos for being one thing above all else, and that is entertaining. People liked these films. They were a lot of fun, and people who saw them when they were young liked them a lot. I'm not too sure how it would play to a 10 or 12-year-old now. I think it would be a little more unkindly looked upon. But if anybody's got a 10 or 12-year-old and wants to experiment by inflicting Death Race 2000 upon them, let me know the results, will you? Because I would be interested. It's interesting to see how children respond to other films. I was talking with a couple of people online who played 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, the Dr. Seuss movie for kids, which was made in about 1951. And apparently it did play well with modern children. So maybe kids are a little bit hip to the absurd. But let me know if you do that, because I'd be interested in knowing what happens with it. Not too much else to say about Death Race 2000, apart from the fact that if you haven't got a copy, get it. It's a lot of fun. I believe you can find tons and tons of it via subterranean means. But even if you buy a DVD, it's not going to put you out of pocket too much, so it may well be worth picking up a DVD copy of it just for your collection. But anyway, I'm going to take another break. Now, I want to get back. I'm going to throw a few ideas about how I think the future of film is going.
Esta es la leyenda de Xanadu.
Ever give yourself to any one man in this cold, wild
me. How will you find your way back one day in Xanadu?
That, of course, was the classic hit from 1968, The Legend of Xanadu by Dave D. Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch. I keep forgetting who was in that band. Anyway, I was thinking today something interesting about the film. Apparently Netflix is possibly looking at coming to Australia in 2014, bringing their movie delivery model to the masses down here. And it occurred to me, because the same day I bought a few Criterion Blu-rays on Amazon.com as a part of my Newton Mass presents from various family members who gave me, for the most part, money. So I was just thinking that looking around here, where basically the whole wall in front of me is insulated by DVDs and Blu-rays. And I was thinking about movies as a product. Now, originally, as we first experienced movies, they were a service. You went into a big building, or even a smaller one in the very early days of cinema, and they delivered an entertainment to you as a service. Whether it was people leaving the Lumiere Brothers factory, or a train pulling into a station, or Charlie Chaplin, or Al Jolson, or Frankenstein, or King Kong, or The Greatest Story Ever Told. It was a service you got from somewhere else. And indeed, television had pretty much the same delivery system. It wasn't a product as much as a service. But along came VHS tapes, and for the first time, in a mass market kind of way, movies became a product. They became a physical artifact that you could purchase. They became something you could take home, lend, give away, sell. There was something you could put into a machine and watch when you wanted to. They were a product, the same way that a record was a product, or a CD, or an 8-track tape, or a cassette. But as we've now dropped into the digital age, and nobody pretty much buys CDs very often these days, or 8-track tapes, LPs, or cassettes for that matter. Movies also are turning back into a product. There's something that you download, watch, and then they disappear mysteriously from your entertainment system, unless you, of course, back them up. Even so, they're not physically visible. I mean, the movies themselves are visible, but the delivery system is an inert box sitting somewhere. And I'm wondering whether how people feel about that, because for me, if I'm paying out money to see a movie in my own home, I kind of like the idea of having the ability to watch it 1,000 times if I want to, or one time if I want to, and having it as something I own rather than something that somebody else delivers to me on demand. Now, maybe it's an old-fashioned viewpoint. Now, in the same way with books, I read digital books on my Kindle a lot, but I also like having a lot of physical books around that I can just pull off a shelf and dip into and take anywhere and watch them when I like, even though, of course, movies are now more portable than they ever were before with iPads and things like that. But I like the idea of having physical manifestations of the money I spent on a product. And how do people feel about that? Are you cool with movies going back to being a service again? Or do you like having a copy of them that you can lend to friends? We're at a weird transition point where we're moving back to, in some ways, an old way of looking at films as something somebody else owns rather than something we own. And even though with copyright laws you never actually own a copy of a DVD or a VHS or Betamax tape, in a practical and real sense you do. And I kind of appreciate that. I've got friends who come over here and I'll lend them a copy of Thief of Baghdad, or I'll lend them some episodes of Danger Man alias Secret Agent with Patrick McGoohan. If they had the same childhood, the same vintage as I did, I'll give them a copy of Gigantor or Prince Planet or the very early Astro Boys. I'll lend them that. You can't do that particularly easily if the movie is an on-demand thing. So let me know what you think about that, cultguru@gmail.com or via the usual means. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'm going to try to line up a guest of some sort for this one. But anyway, enjoy your movie watching and watch the skies in the meantime. I'll be back very soon, just before Newton Mass.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.